Hi, Ted here. Here's a little context for today's show. About a week, 10 days ago, we had the good fortune to interview Lindsay Baxter Griffith, who is a director of federal policy at the Clean Air Task Force. We made two shows. One was about the Clean Energy Performance Program, which is the federal mechanism in the Biden plan to get all utilities in the United States to adopt clean energy. We put up an episode where we talked about the mechanics of that plan and what it meant, how it worked. We made a second episode about the state of play, the political state of play in Washington, D.C., and what it looked like for the passage of the clean energy payment program, which fits into the Build Back Better legislation. Of course, at the time, we were concerned that we didn't know the future, right? But the discussion in the podcast was quite interesting. A lot of interesting background, useful background about the program. And that's important because between the time that we recorded the episode and the time we're posting it, our friend Joe Manchin decided that he had developed a case of the SADS about the Clean Energy Performance Program, and that there's a New York Times report saying that the Biden administration is removing the CEPP from the Build Back Better program, which is outrageous. I think that that possibility is all the more important to understand, listen to the podcast, understand what the background of the CEPP is. And it's important to keep in mind that just because the New York Times puts up a report saying what Biden might be thinking about because Joe Manchin has finally dropped his opposition to the total dollar amount and is now explicitly saying that he does not like the clean energy provision, right? That's where his problem is. That means we need to push back. The game's not over. We need to. If you're listening to this podcast, I suggest you call your senator. You can get to the Senate switchboard at phone number. Here's a phone number. Get your pen out. 202-224-3121. Right? 202-224-3121. Should call your senator and urge them to insist that the Clean Energy Performance Program be maintained in the Build Back Better legislation. Anyway, so there you go. As Casey Stengel, I guess, said, telling the it's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. This podcast that's coming up was from before the time that this report on Joe Manchin's opposition hadn't come forward, but it's still a useful listen to understand what's going on. So there you go. Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is being recorded in early October. And that's important because things change, you know. If you've been watching the news, you know that there is a gigantic sort of battle going on in Washington, D.C. Someone referred to it as an omni-crisis, right? We have the debt ceiling, we have voting bills, we have infrastructure packages, we have the reconciliation package, we have all these huge pieces of legislation very much needed for our country flying around looking for a place to land. In particular, one of those pieces of legislation is called a reconciliation bill, or it has now gotten a new acronym called the Build Back Better program, I believe. The Build Back Better program is a collection of many important policy proposals. Of course, we have to keep peeling the onion back, and we're interested in a particular element of this reconciliation bill that relates to climate change, right? The climate provisions. It's important to know, though, that one of the issues that, that this bill is called a reconciliation bill because of strange rules in the U.S. Senate that are outdated, and but they still exist, by which the only viable path for passing climate legislation is through a means called reconciliation, which basically talks about dollars. There have to be dollars in the federal budget that are affected by the legislation. And as a consequence, that's why this bill would get to evade the filibuster blockade, right? Long story short, the reconciliation, we need to get 50 votes for this reconciliation package. And you've probably seen Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin on TV more than you want to. Anyway, we are thrilled to have with us today Lindsay Baxter Griffith, who is the Director of Federal Policy at the Clean Air Task Force, which is a nonprofit, 25-year-old nonprofit working to decarbonize the global energy system. Lindsay worked with Ed Markey, the great senator from Massachusetts, on climate issues. She has worked as the chief of staff at an office within the Department of Energy. She has a degree from the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, so she knows what she's talking about. She's familiar with sort of the, I should say, to use the old phrase, the sausage making down in D.C., and we wanted to find out how all this stuff was coming together. So, Lindsay, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me again. Glad to be back.
So Lindsay, there is a lot going on in D.C. I just made a mince pie of the whole discussion of reconciliation and the climate stuff. But tell me, what are the climate provisions of the reconciliation bill? Do they look strong? What are the objections? What's going to happen? As far as we can see in this sort of cloudy crystal ball we're looking at in early October.
Well, if you find someone who can read the crystal ball, please send them my way, because I think we're all watching this with, frankly, a lot of anxiety and a lot of excitement, too. You know, I think a lot of this, if, you know, I'm sure your listeners remember, goes all the way back to the fact that both Senator Warnock and Senator Ossoff won close races in the state of Georgia earlier this year, which put the Senate, the U.S. Senate, in a 50-50 tie. Now, because the presidency had gone to Joe Biden, the president of the Senate is actually Vice President Kamala Harris. So in the event of a tie vote on 50, she casts a deciding vote. So in effect, the Democrats hold a 51-50 majority in the U.S. Senate. That's as tight, as slim a margin as you can possibly get. And it means that the traditional rules in the Senate mean that you have to have a filibuster-proof majority to pass legislation. You have to have 60 votes to do almost anything according to the rules of the Senate. Now, one thing that you need only 50 votes to do is pass a budget reconciliation package, which brings together budgets that were passed in both the House and the Senate. And that's, you're right, that's why this sort of spending mechanism is so key, because this is a huge tool. It's a very strange tool. It's not the usual way that policy gets done in Washington. And it's certainly not, I think, what a lot of us who've been working on climate policy here in the US and even in the Senate thought we would have to be constrained by when we were designing different policies. So essentially the menu of options available to us is quite a bit smaller than I think folks anticipated. What that means is we're really in an environment where I think staff and members have looked at all of the different programs we currently have in the federal government, in all of our agencies, at the Department of Energy, at the Environmental Protection Agency, and said, okay, where can we put budget? Where can we put funds and construct these programs and use these programs in a way that will allow us to make progress on climate? So that's really a handcuffed way to think about climate policy. But fortunately, you know, there are actually a lot of great things that have been teed up. One of them is the Clean Electricity Performance Program that the House Energy and Commerce Committee has advanced. And we talked a little bit about this, but just a quick overview, that policy would use financial incentives, both carrots and sticks, to encourage eligible suppliers of retail electricity to increase their share of clean electricity from their baseline levels starting in 2023 by 4 percentage points each year, all the way through 2030. So that policy would essentially provide incentives to really reduce emissions in the electricity sector, which is the second largest emitting sector of the US economy, just behind transportation. And, you know, it's going to be key to decarbonization in a whole lot of other sectors, right? In industrial, in transportation itself, in other areas. So it's a really important place to start. And it's key to President Biden's proposed nationally determined contribution and other climate commitments that we make massive reductions in the electricity sector in the next decade. So this policy is a real key linchpin. The other thing I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention is clean energy tax credits are the other sort of big tool that's available in budget reconciliation. Tax policy has actually been done on budget reconciliation as recently as 2017. The Trump tax cuts were done through budget reconciliation. So there's a lot of precedent there. And there's some really aggressive, exciting proposals that have come out of both the House Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee this year to expand tax credits for renewable energy, for clean firm electricity technologies. You need those incentives to the developers at the same time as you're providing incentives to those who would purchase the electricity, right? So if you have both of those things, it really amplifies the power and we can really deploy a lot of things quickly.
And Lizzie, just to put a fine edge on that, I mean, the place where that comes home to roost, say in Massachusetts, is that the tax credits that the federal government extends to the people who who put the wind turbines out in the ocean, that's what makes those projects viable, right? And so it's really an important piece. And I think this legislation extends the horizon that those tax credits will be available through like the rest of the decade or something. But
right.
It sounds kind of this like wonky, tax credits, you know, who cares? But really, that's part of a very important financial aspect of actually building the wind and solar farms. And that's in the reconciliation bill, right?
That is, yeah. So reconciliation one really interesting aspect of it is you have to be budget neutral after 10 years. That's part of the requirement. So essentially, you can design policy all the way out. You can put these payments and anything else in place for 10 years, these tax credits. It just has to become budget neutral in the 10th year. So it's, yeah, they're really.
Which means just whole... so define budget neutral. Forgive me. That's sounds like something you say in the Senate and everyone understands, but no one outside does.
Yeah. So what it means is essentially there is no cost associated with it in the 10th year. So federal spending over in that period will then be no greater than it would have been if you didn't have this in place. So it's a very strange term. It's a fiscal policy where no program, no budget, none of these things will have impact on the budget in year 10. So everything has to wind down essentially. There are some odd tweaks you can make. So you could have revenue raisers and so essentially you could have taxes, right, that are offsetting the cost of credits going out. But that all has to pencil out at the end of the decade.
Not to throw a hand grenade into our discussion, but the whole question of modern monetary theory, which I think basically says that all this budget neutrality stuff is hogwash and just sort of this myth we tell ourselves. But I mean, that's a whole other program. We don't have a whole other podcast. We don't really have time to go into. So, right. Basically now over this, everything we're talking about in this bill is budget neutral at the end of 10 years, everything zeroes out. The income and the outgo are the same and everybody's happy, right? That's why we can talk about it
right
in reconciliation.
There, right. Up until that point, though, you know, there will be costs associated with what happens in budget reconciliation. The way that the bills have been written, and it's a combination of costs across everything from healthcare to, you know, right, labor provisions and everything else, all of that has a total amount that it's going to cost. You know, and then that's been a part of what's been in the headlines a lot lately, right? Is this going to be a $4 trillion package? Is it going to be 2.5? Is it going to be one? I think that's really, you know, if I were to characterize the debate right now in Washington, we're still kind of at that point where everybody is arguing over these top line numbers, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And the question, you know, the way that the House Clean Energy Performance Program has been designed, it would cost upwards of $100 billion over the lifetime of the program, which is 10 years. So it's an expensive program.
Save the planet, $100 billion seems like a good deal.
I know. You and I know that feels like pennies, but when you're, you know, when you're starting to parse out like how you're going to spend what might end up being only $1.5 or $2 trillion, and you're including things like the child mm-hmm. tax credits, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of big expensive policies on the table. So I think that's, you know, one of the most important things for listeners to understand, though, is that the climate pieces of this are actually not the most expensive, but I think, you know, and I know, like, these could have incredible impacts because of the cost they'll reduce over mm-hmm. the next decade. So, you know, so around...
Lindsay, what's the state of play of this bill? I mean, I think we've all seen on TV where, as you say, Joe Manchin says, "Oh, $3.5 trillion, I can't accept that," and then he walks into the elevator or something, right? And that's the negotiation. How could things change? What could get everybody, or at least these two recalcitrant Democratic senators, to accept a package? I'm asking you again, we'll stipulate that who knows really what's going to happen, right? But I mean, you know more than most people. What do you think?
Well, you know, in just the last week, I think we've seen some really interesting shifting politics on this. So at the end of September, which as we're talking was only about a week ago, there were self-imposed deadlines in place in the House. They were going to take a vote on a different piece of legislation, the bipartisan infrastructure package. Now, that piece of legislation moved out of the Senate over the summer, I think at the end of August, and actually received votes from both Democrats and Republicans. So it went through on a more than 60 vote approval. But in order for something to become law, you have to pass the House. And so, you know, I think there were, now President Biden has went to Capitol Hill, met with members, and they had discussions about these two pieces of legislation. And, you know, it became pretty clear that progressives in the House Progressive Caucus, and others really are looking for a lot of the things that are in the reconciliation package to pass as well, and weren't comfortable seeing the bipartisan package pass without seeing some progress being made on reconciliation. So they made the choice to hold their negotiating line and not agree to move forward on that vote last week. So we now have both of these pieces of legislation still in front of Congress. You know, both are in the House right now. The House will have to take action on both of them before the Senate can. So that's really where we are. We're sort of waiting for the House to advance reconciliation and advance this bipartisan bill.
The House won't advance the reconciliation bill until they get confirmation that the Senate will accept it, sort of a wink and a nod from Joe Manchin. Is that the deal?
I think the idea, you know, with budget reconciliation, the goal is to have, you know, if I'm putting myself in the shoes of the Speaker of the House right now, I would guess that the goal is to try and have as few votes as possible. You really want the process to be as smooth and as quick as you can. And budget reconciliation already has so many hurdles, right? But to get this process, it will be very hard. It's a really high bar to have the House pass a version of their legislation that will also pass the Senate. But I would say, you know, when I sit from where I'm sitting, that's the goal, right? Mm-hmm. If we could get to a point where, in particular, these climate policies, like some version of an electricity sector payment and, you know, program, something like that could move forward. And it may not look like the version that the House has put forward. The House bill is very aggressive. It's absolutely at the top of, you know, 4 percentage points per year is aggressive. It's a very well-designed policy. I think there are things about it that will be up for negotiation as we move forward. And the key thing here is that as those negotiations proceed, we just have to make sure that the policy is still robust enough, right? That it's still going to get the emissions reductions and the changes that we need in the electricity system over the next decade. That's really what I am watching for very closely on that particular policy.
So tell me, I have seen discussion that says speaking broadly, there's a $3.5 trillion bill over 10 years. And Joe Manchin says $3.5 trillion is too much. So you could easily say, okay, I'm going to make it $1.75 trillion over 5 years, right? And at least pass it for 5 years, you know, the whole entire package, and then say in 5 years we'll come back. Do you think that that's viable, or does the CEPP need the full 10-year run to be built in for it to be successful?
Sorry, could you repeat that one more time?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
I guess the question is, we have the one way to make Joe Manchin happy is, for example, to say that the CEPP will only run for 5 years, will therefore only cost half as much, and he can vote for it. Would that be something that works, or in the design of the program, you say, you know, you really need to have the 10-year horizon so that the utilities, you know, feel comfortable with the investments they have to make?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, there are a lot of ways to reduce the costs of the bill overall, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I'd go back to what I said earlier, which is that the overall cost of an electricity sector program is going to be small compared to other ways you might reduce the top line of the bill. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there are things that can be done on this policy to reduce costs. One would be to change the payments and fees, right? You can still probably provide the same incentive, the same push on this industry, on utilities, if you're providing a slightly different and perhaps, you know, a fee and a payment that are closer in value than the House proposal. That's one way to think about it. You know, I think there's also, you know, a way to think about, you know, we need policy certainty in the electricity sector. I think you're right about that. And that's where, you know, the 10-year timeframe is important. Yeah. But you also, I think, you know, we know a little bit about Senator Manchin's priorities, right? He actually, the leak of the memo agreement that he had with Leader Schumer indicated on climate that he's interested in spending on innovation and not on elimination. So for him, that means a policy like this would need to be fuel neutral, right? So you would need to have, you know, options for, you know, building natural gas if you were going to have carbon capture, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's something he would probably say. In fact, the memo calls out that carbon capture and storage be included and that those can feasibly qualify under the program. You know, he also called for, you know, tax credits for if, you know, if there's going to be tax credits for wind and other renewables to be included and extended, then he also wants to see fossil tax credits, not repealed. So there are some challenges there, right? There are some things that are on the table here and, you know, and Schumer, to his credit on the memo, I think he wrote, something to the tune of, you know, I will try and, you know, work with Joe to change his mind about some of these things. So, you know, some of these things are going to be deal breakers in the climate space, and some of them are not. There are ways to design policies that will work with some of these things that are being suggested. And in particular, actually, the bipartisan package, which Joe Manchin supported, included a lot of innovation-focused policies. So really, it is the pairing politically of that bipartisan package with this reconciliation package that they each make the other possible politically, is what I would say. So, you know, they're continuing to be pulled closer and closer into each other's orbit. And, you know, I think we'll see this month and probably into the rest of the year if they're both able to sort of survive that collision.
Well, Lindsay, what we'll do is we'll save this podcast and maybe you can come back after the bill is passed and we can have a laugh about the things that we've said.
Oh, boy.
We can take a listen and say, oh, yeah. Because all of this is up in the air, but I appreciate very much your thoughts. It helps people sort of understand the complexities of what is going on down in Washington. It's really important that this battle be won with the policies intact. So
anyway, well, it changes all the time here in DC, and I'm just glad that you and your listeners care enough about being a part of systems change, right? Because that is just so key. We can do only so much as individuals, but making changes in the system, which I think we're hoping to do this year with policy, is certainly an important part of the role I think we all have to play.
Super. Well, what we'll do is I'll put up some links to the things we talked about and the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. So that's where the hot links for the things we talked about in this show will be. If you have questions about the show or suggestions of things we ought to talk about, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what's good, what's bad, what's ugly, what we ought to be talking about from your perspective. You're probably listening to this show on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution app because we're on all of them. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade, under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investments, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities in order to safeguard our collective future. So, Lindsay, thank you so much for being here. It's been very instructive.
Oh, thanks. It's always great to be here.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.